received, I think, going on 5-6 calls just in the last week of folks who have received the letter and just are really confused.
Concern over an end to food stamps for thousands of Alaskans. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the U.S. Senate grapples with trying to pull funding from Planned Parenthood.
A move to wholesale defund Planned Parenthood is just not smart.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. The University of Alaska Southeast School of Management offers online college degrees for the unconventional student or working professional who wants learning on their schedule and timeline. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
A change in state policy will end access to food stamps for thousands of Alaskans. A letter sent out from the Division of Public Assistance in June to all state residents receiving food stamps says able-bodied adults without dependents who don't meet the program's work requirements will no longer be eligible 3 months into the new year. Most food stamp recipients will not be affected. The work requirements affect those who are between ages 18 and 49, do not have a noted disability status, and have no dependents. However, the letter has left many worried they'll lose vital access to food. Derek Pennington works with a group in Wasilla that connects seniors to public assistance and says clients have been asking for clarity.
We've received, I think, going on 5-6 calls just in the last week of folks who have received the letter and just are really confused about whether or not their benefits are going to be impacted. And it looks like most of the folks that we serve are part of the exemption list.
Work requirements have been a contentious part of public assistance rules since a 1996 change to the federal laws. Alaska suspended the work requirements in 2004 because of high unemployment rates, but improvements in the national economy have prompted many states to end their exemptions. The state's Department of Health and Social Services has also fielded questions from concerned citizens, according to Public Information Officer Sarana Shell. In an email, Shell says Alaska's improving employment figures make it ineligible for a statewide waiver. However, officials have requested a waiver for all individual boroughs and villages with unemployment rates that are 20% above the national average. The only area not covered by that request is Anchorage, where as many as 3,000 residents stand to be affected. Shell says the public assistance director's letter is intended to inform recipients about how to meet work requirements so as to keep as many people as possible qualified for the food stamps program. The White House and the EPA today released the final version of its rule to cut carbon emissions from power plants. The administration's Clean Power Plan sets targets that states have to meet and requires them to submit plans detailing how they will achieve them. But Alaska will not have to comply with new mandates, at least not yet. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports on this morning's surprise announcement.
Senator Lisa Murkowski says she got word in a phone call from EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy.
And she said, I listened to you.
In the draft rule, Alaska would have had to cut emissions by 26%. Murkowski, at a hearing in April, told McCarthy the target was unreachable and that Alaska was different, in part because its limited grid is cut off from other states. The final rule says the EPA doesn't have enough information to set target reductions for Alaska and other areas cut off from the national grid. Murkowski says that's also what McCarthy told her.
And she said, we realized that we didn't have the data, and we didn't have the data for good reason, because it effectively doesn't exist. And so she said, we felt that we could not advance this, at least for some time.
The new national rule requires other states to eliminate about a third of the carbon dioxide emissions from power plants by 2030. The final rule doesn't apply to Alaska, Hawaii, Guam, or Puerto Rico.
Actually, I wouldn't use the word exempt I would use the word defer.
That's Janet McCabe, head of the EPA Air Regulation Office.
We intend to work with those jurisdictions and other sources to get information and move forward to finalize a plan. We do not set out a schedule for that at this time, but we will move forward with that.
Murkowski says she repeatedly pressed McCarthy on when the rules for the non-contiguous areas might be ready, and she got no definite answer. The senator says it was her impression time might run out on the Obama administration before then. Murkowski was visibly happy about the news. Now the question is whether she, as chairman of the Senate Energy Committee, will join Republican efforts to block the rule from going into effect in other states. Murkowski says she hasn't had enough time to look at the final version. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A bill to defund Planned Parenthood failed a procedural vote in the U.S. Senate today. Senator Dan Sullivan is a co-sponsor of the bill. Senator Lisa Murkowski voted to advance the defunding measure also, but she says she doesn't want to see Planned Parenthood's funding removed without an investigation.
A move to wholesale defund Planned Parenthood is just not smart.
Murkowski says she wanted the bill to advance so she could vote for an amendment offered by Republican moderates Susan Collins of Maine and Mark Kirk of Illinois. That measure would have required the Justice Department to investigate whether Planned Parenthood or its affiliates violated federal law regarding the harvest of fetal tissue. The Collins-Kirk measure would have cut off funding just to the facilities, if any, that profited from that practice. The reasons Murkowski is giving for her vote are new and likely to be lost in the heated debate. After the vote, the Alaska Democratic Party issued a statement headlined, "Murkowski Abandons Alaska Women." On the other side, Jim Minery of Alaska Family Action has been urging his anti-abortion followers to tell Murkowski to support the bill. Murkowski, who is up for re-election next year, has had a complex stand on abortion since her days in the Alaska legislature, and she has alternately pleased and angered both sides of the abortion debate. Murkowski says she knows people will read a lot of meaning into today's vote. She says she believes Planned Parenthood does good work, and she notes that it provides health care to 21,000 Alaskans.
What I'm opposed to is any measure that would completely defund good services to men and women, important services to men and women, unless there has been illegal action. And we don't know whether there has been.
She says she was repulsed by the videos taken by anti-abortion activists in which Planned Parenthood officials discuss compensation for providing fetal tissue for research. Murkowski today asked the U.S. Attorney General for an investigation. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a donation to help island communities.
In the event that another disaster is declared, what do we do and how do we move forward? We need to come up with a long-term plan.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
Crews are sampling water and sediments this summer near the site of the old Red Devil Mercury mine in the Middle Kuskokwim. It's work that comes in advance of a large cleanup project. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
Work has been underway for years to study how to clean up the abandoned mine, and there's still more to learn. Mike McCrum is the Red Devil project manager for the Bureau of Land Management.
We still had unanswered questions with regard to any tailings that have made their way into the Kuskokwim River. And we also had some unanswered questions for groundwater on the mine site.
Researchers will be putting in monitoring wells and soon will sample sediments in the Kuskokwim. The cleanup work is split into two major phases now as leaders finalize a feasibility study for cleaning up the 250,000 cubic yards of tailings that have been leaching mercury, arsenic, and antimony into the Kuskokwim River for years. That's leading up to a multi-million dollar project to stop the tailings from releasing hazardous materials.
In the end, it's, you know, the most important thing is to address those tailings. They're still piled up next to Red Devil Creek. That's really not a good place for them to be. And the issues that we're working on now are not whether, they really are not, are we going to do anything? The issues are more, what is it that we're going to do? What's the most efficient and optimal thing for us to do?
Last summer, they completed some work to regrade tailings piles so they were not so steep, plus excavating a new channel and creating a new area of still water in which sediments could drop out before reaching the river. The options under consideration now include simply fencing off the site or digging up the tailings.
To do a pretty extensive excavation in the Red Devil Creek Valley, removing virtually all the tailings that are there, the soil that's been impacted by those tailings, scraping off the top of the barge landing, and placing that material in a repository on the north end of the site, which is at a quite a bit higher elevation. It's up away from any surface water. And we would cap that with a very low permeability cap.
Keeping water out would stop the leaching. The final and most expensive option by far would be to actually barge out the materials and take them to a hazardous waste facility in Oregon.
It's common to simply remove them from the location where they're creating an environmental issue. In this case, it's being near the water. It's the aquatic ecosystem that's the most sensitive to the metals that are being released by the tailings. And so getting those tailings up and away from the water is probably the single most important thing that you can do.
The barging alternative would involve 123 transits and cost $285 million. Keeping the material on site would cost $35 million. The BLM plans to take out a proposed plan to Kuskokwim communities in early 2016. A final decision is expected next year, and the agency hopes that work could be done within a few years. Additional sediment work would come later. The Red Devil Mercury Mine operated from 1933 to 1971. By the 1980s, it was considered abandoned, and the government began the long process of cleaning up. Studies have found buildup of metals in fish nearby, and the state has issued a warning to residents not to collect subsistence foods nearby. They also warn pregnant women and young children to avoid large-sized pike and lush. Those are predators that can accumulate mercury over the years. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
State troopers are investigating an assault in Kotlik after a pregnant victim's baby died. Troopers say a family member assaulted the pregnant woman, and following the assault, the woman's child was lost due to unknown circumstances. They're looking at whether the loss of the fetus was connected with the assault. Troopers learned of the incident Thursday morning and responded to the village. The alleged assault took place last Monday. The investigation is still underway, according to a trooper dispatch. Troopers say any charges, if warranted, will be sent to the district attorney's office. Most people working in a newborn intensive care unit have some type of advanced medical degree, but one employee at the Children's Hospital at Providence in Anchorage has a very different set of qualifications. Ginny Schaefer spent more than 3 months in the NICU as a parent with her daughter, who was born at 23 weeks. Now she helps other families through one of the most stressful times of their lives as a parent navigator. APRN's Annie Feit has the story.
A mini chalkboard outside Emily Bresler's NICU room playfully charts her escape attempts from the hospital. Her mom, Liz, says she's come close to going home at least a dozen times in the last 4 months.
Someone would come in the room and they'd say, well, you could probably be out of here in 2 weeks. She's doing good right now. And then at the end of 2 weeks, something would happen. I called them her little medical temper tantrums. And it was just enough to keep her here.
Emily had her first medical temper tantrum the day after she was born, a hearty 8 pounds, 1 ounce in Fairbanks. She started vomiting, couldn't poop, and was medevaced to the Providence NICU in Anchorage. Emily was diagnosed with Hirschsprung's disease, which affects the colon. She needed surgery, 3 in all, to be able to pass stool. Bresler's husband had to stay home in Fairbanks, caring for the couple's 3 other young kids.
I kind of keep my sanity by cracking jokes, and we make the best signs. Emily's got one that says, kiss my little red wagon, and if you wake me, you take me, and And it's just, it's great to have that lightness.
The other half of that we Bresler is talking about is NICU parent navigator Ginny Schaefer.
If I can make her smile with a sign, then we're going to make as many signs as possible.
Schaefer has also helped Bresler find a spot for her espresso machine, a vital piece of equipment when your home is a hospital room. And then there's the tougher stuff. Schaefer is someone Bresler can talk to when Emily has a surgery or a setback. She also helps Bresler advocate for Emily's unique care needs with doctors. Schaefer says each family needs help in different ways.
I want to walk into a room and I want somebody to see that there's somebody that's going to help them and it's just their needs, you know, that I'm looking to support.
10 years ago, Schaefer was the one who needed support. She was 23 weeks pregnant with twins, a boy and a girl, when she felt funny and went to the hospital. Her tiny babies were born 5 hours later. Her son Bryson experienced seizures, brain bleeds, and problems with internal organs. When he was 45 days old, Schaefer and her husband made the difficult decision to remove life support. The day after Bryson died, a nurse suggested a first bath for their daughter, Holland.
And they got out this little bitty pink hospital basin, this little tub that was too big for her, and this heat lamp. And we got this really great photo. And nurse said, how many people does it take to give a 2-pound baby a bath? And we're all smiling, 5. And that was a really pivotal moment in our life because I didn't really know how to go forward.
Holland spent 99 days in the NICU. After that experience, Schaefer was glad to be home, but she missed the daily connections with hospital staff and other NICU families. When Holland was 2 years old, the NICU parent navigator job opened up, and it seemed like a natural fit for Schaefer, even though her background is in real estate, not healthcare. 8 years later, Schaefer's office, with huge glass windows, is the first thing you see when walking into the unit. It's filled with stuffed animals, infant clothes, and a bowl of chocolate to entice parents to sit down and talk. Schaefer also works to get families connecting with each other.
We try and get creative with some of our offerings. We've done National Fried Chicken Day, a quirky celebration, but, you know, it kind of creates a giggle, and then people are curious, like, the NICU celebrating National Fried Chicken Day? Let's go see what it's about. And then just to be able to serve them up a meal, and connections are made.
Another piece of Schaefer's job is advocating for families with hospital administrators. She helped design the new NICU that opened 2 years ago to be as parent and baby friendly as possible. Right now, she's pushing for a more relaxed visitors policy. No visitors are allowed at shift change when confidential information is exchanged. It's a holdover from the days when the unit was open with no private rooms.
You know, if my neighbor's here and she's my best friend and she can help me while I'm breastfeeding or get me a tissue or get me a drink, then why not let her stay when you can shut my door and give me some privacy and then I won't overhear the confidential exchange of information that happens at shift change.
Not your mama. Back to mama.
But one of the best job perks for Schaefer is celebrating family milestones. And a recent day brings a big one. A parade of doctors and nurses are stopping by Emily Bresler's room to say goodbye and take pictures. After 127 days in the NICU, she is finally making her escape.
Howdy, howdy.
Congratulations.
How are you doing?
Very good. Well, time to go home.
All right. Time to go home.
Okay. I got the discharge summary and everything.
Bresler is thrilled to be going home to her husband and kids, but sad, too, to say goodbye to the support network of Schaefer and all the NICU staff. She says it's a little like trading one family for another. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
To see a slideshow of Emily Bresler leaving the NICU after her long stay, go to alaskapublic.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
These days, being into STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, doesn't make a girl a geek, it makes the world a better place. If you like numbers, nature, computers, and figuring out how the world really works, go to beanengineeralaska.com. You just might like what you learn. And it's not just for girls. This message on Alaska Public Media brought to you by ExxonMobil in Alaska.
Help is on the way for four communities affected by this spring's poor walrus harvest in the Bering Strait region in the form of 10,000 pounds of halibut. Nearly 200 boxes of the fish were delivered to Nome last week, according to Donna James, the senior planner at regional nonprofit Koerik. She says the delivery is being sorted and will soon be distributed to the communities of Diomede, Gamble, Savunga, and Wales. The halibut comes as a donation from SeaShare, a Washington State nonprofit that supplies seafood to hunger relief efforts. All four communities declared states of economic disaster after a spring harvest that Vera Metcalf calls significantly worse than usual. Metcalf is the director of the Eskimo Walrus Commission and worked with the communities to declare their disasters. She says the commission reached out to the state of Alaska and the governor's office for help through Representative Neil Foster and Senator Donnie Olson.
This staff were really good about following up with our concerns, making sure that the communities were aware that the state of Alaska and Walker's administration were aware of the situation. And, you know, this halibut came around and it was available and it's free, and the communities wanted access to that.
The U.S. Coast Guard brought the frozen halibut to Nome free of charge, and James says Koerik is working with local carriers Bering Air, Erickson, and Raven Alaska to organize free freight delivery to the four communities. Although the donation is good news, Metcalf says it's only a temporary solution as climate change makes hunting more difficult.
In the event that another disaster is declared, what do we do and how do we move forward? We need to come up with a long-term plan.
For now, Metcalf says the donation will be a big help, even if it doesn't entirely solve the food shortages.
I know it won't fill the nutritional value that walrus or other marine mammals provide, but it's there and it'll be put to good use.
The halibut will ship out as soon as Koerik can coordinate delivery with the different airlines. The nonprofit intends to distribute the fish equally to households in each community. 16-year-old Wallace Unguiluk is a standout point guard for his basketball team in Gamble on St. Lawrence Island, but the game could carry this high school junior 2,000 miles from home to Seattle, where he's been recruited to play for a private high school. This summer, Unguiluk has a decision to make: stay home and try to win Gamble its first championship in 30 years, or move to Seattle and get exposure to college scouts. KNOM's Laura Craigle caught up with him during basketball practice in the Gamble gym.
According to Alvin Aniyu, there's nothing like a home game in Gamble.
It's a raucous, rowdy, exciting, electrified environment. When we win, you know, you can feel the excitement, the buzz. When we lose, you can feel their heart breaking just as our heart's breaking. It's just incredible.
Aniyu is coach of the Gamble boys basketball team, and he says it's Wallace Unguiluk who's been getting the crowd going in recent years.
I started playing probably ever since I started walking.
That's Wallace. He's the team's captain, point guard, and top scorer. As a sophomore last season, he averaged over 27 points per game, nearly double the production of Gamble's second-best scorer. And Coach Aniyu says he's just getting better.
He's special. He started to shine there, and he's continually trying to get better. That's what we need, you know, not having players settle.
Wallace was in Anchorage last summer for a basketball camp. He trained, worked on his game, and for the first time, saw just how far basketball could take him.
That was like the first time I've really ever been coached. I pushed that hard. I went to that camp not thinking I'd get much exposure there, but I actually did, and I was quite surprised. Because this is like a big opportunity for me.
That's the opportunity to move to Seattle, attend a private school, and play competitive ball. The offer comes from Seattle Lutheran High School, which had a solid postseason last year and is planning for a deep run in this year's state tournament. But the offer comes at a critical time for Wallace and his hometown team. Gamble is looking to improve after a string of early exits from the Bering Strait School District's annual tournament. In the last 2 years, Gamble has been knocked out quickly, and Wallace wants to help turn the team around and contend for the title.
I do want to stay here in this village and win a championship for this village, because it hasn't been done in about 30 years. But I'm not only thinking about my high school career, I'm also thinking about after high school, and I want to play college basketball, and my best chance for that is getting exposure in Seattle.
Wallace says Western Alaska is no hotbed for college recruitment, and he knows most scouts don't make it to St. Lawrence Island. Even after writing letters to 12 colleges and making a YouTube video of his highlights, Wallace isn't sure he can crack a college lineup if he stays in Gamble.
No one's really heard of me, but Seattle, they got colleges all around Seattle, and they got scouts there too. Gives me a better chance.
But Seattle would also be a big change. In Gamble, Wallace gets around on his four-wheeler, often with his 12-year-old brother Skyly. He loves boating, snowboarding, and doing subsistence hunting with his family. His dad, Rodney, has home movies of Wallace's first whale hunting trip. And his mom, Yuka, makes his favorite meal, walrus. Life in Seattle would be different. And Wallace worries about being homesick, getting lost in a big city, and having to make new friends at school. But he takes pride in representing Gamble. Coach Aningyu says he'll support Wallace whether he stays in Gamble or takes his talents to Seattle Lutheran.
If he decides to stay, I think it's going to be a breakout year for Gamble.
And if not,
he has a chance at actually making a living off of playing basketball, something he loves, and you know, that'd be a great success for him, for the community also.
Either way, Wallace says he won't be leaving Gamble for good.
I want to study business, and I want to come back out here to this village because the unemployment rate here is super high. And I want to be able to like establish something like where there could be jobs for everybody, because it's hard to live out here. And that's one reason why I want to go out to college, and I'll be coming back.
Until then, Wallace will attend 3 summer basketball camps and think about his decision. His final stop will be Seattle, where Wallace and his dad will tour his prospective school and meet with Seattle Lutheran coaches in person. He'll make his final decision after that visit. Reporting in Gamble, I'm Laura Craigle.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Ben Matheson in Bethel, and Laura Craigle in Nome. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C., and Annie Fight from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety. The Alaska Marine Conservation Council reminds Alaskans to choose local, sustainably caught seafood this summer. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.